United States, Great Britain, the people of Afghanistan face a security emergency, and that security emergency is the loss of control. The United States has to manage its real and short-term security needs by waging this campaign against militants in Western Pakistan while not letting go of the security emergency in the short run.
Our guest today, Steve Call, recently became president and CEO of the New America Foundation. Central to the mission of the New America Foundation is investing in developing the creative young minds most capable of crafting new policy positions for the United States. This is a mission, actually, that's very close to the mission of the Miller Center's American Political Development Program in nurturing young scholars and outstanding young policymakers. To carry out their mission, New America could not have selected one any better than Steve Call to bring new voices and new ideas to the forefront of America's public discourse. Steve Call is one of America's most highly respected and honored journalists. He is the author of five books, ranging from The Deal of the Century, The Breakup of AT&T, to On the Grand Trunk Road, A Journey into South Asia, to the book that was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in 2004, Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden, From the Soviet Invasion to September 10th, 2001. That was actually Steve Call's second Pulitzer. He won his first in 1990 for explanatory journalism for his coverage of the Securities and Exchange Commission. He's a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Occidental College. He was named managing editor of the Washington Post when he was a mere child of 40 years old. And he left the Post several years ago to become a staff writer at the New Yorker. A position he will continue while he is at the New America Foundation. He is finishing up a book on Saudi Arabia, the Bin Laden family, that touches on Pakistan and Afghanistan as well. And he has just returned safely, we observe, within the past several days from his most recent trip to Karachi. Please welcome Steve Call.
Thank you. Thank you, George. It is terrific to be back here. I think it's my third time since I was here last. I noticed you've put some tape on the floor and inaugurated a whole series of other improvements. But I really enjoy coming down here. It's such an enriching environment. And thank you, Governor, for having me here at the Miller Center today. I fear that you've been brought together somewhat by false pretense, because while the title of my talk promises you understanding about Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Saudi Arabia, in fact, if you want understanding about Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia, you'll have to ask me questions after my remarks are completed, because I think I'm going to talk during the 25 minutes or so that I have primarily about Pakistan, since it's very fresh in my mind. Last night, I don't know how many of you watched the Democratic debate last night. What excellent citizens. That is remarkable. That is really an anomaly, I would say. I did as well. And so those of you who put your hands up probably heard Senator Biden, I think, started out by saying that he thought Pakistan was the most dangerous problem in American foreign policy. And Senator Clinton and some others, when their turn came, quickly echoed that thought, but then offered no particular commentary about what it implied and what we might do about it, which I fear, without criticism of any of them, I'm glad to hear Pakistan introduced even as a headline into national discourse. It does reflect a structural problem in American foreign policy, which is the mismatch between the degree of urgency and complexity that Pakistan presents not only to the United States, but also to Great Britain and other allies, versus the amount of attention, thought, care, and policy-making capacity that Pakistan receives. So I thought what I would do with my time is to try to give you something of a sort of spectator's guide to this most, or possibly most dangerous problem in American foreign policy. Certainly, I think we could find consensus that it belongs in the top three or four. And I'll start with just what I've done over the last couple of weeks, which was to fly back into Pakistan with Benazir Bhutto as she returned from exile, the sort of thing that journalists do. I've been following Benazir for 20 years as a reporter. When I first went overseas for the Washington Post, I was stationed in India, and I spent quite a lot of time in Pakistan during her first time in office. She is a remarkable, fascinating, compelling, complicated political personality and remains so. I had the opportunity to speak with her before she went back, and she was in great, sort of in fine feather. She reminded me of a sort of a performer, an actress who had a spectacular career in her 20s and then hadn't been called for any roles for about 10 years and had now been summoned back to the stage, and her voice was in full training, it seemed to me. She is, among other things, a very gifted political performer, and that served her well under the stress of her return. The journey itself was part drama, part farce. We flew in on a United Arab Emirates, Emirates Airlines commercial flight from Dubai. About half of the passengers were journalists, and the other half were activists in the Pakistan People's Party who had been up for about two nights chanting, singing, and if the truth was told, drinking rather heavily. And they were shouting, and the poor, it sounded like Australian or maybe South African pilot of the Emirates flight kept coming on the PA telling people to calm down and stop singing in the aisles and stop congregating in the aisles. And he kept, one of his lines was, "There are normal passengers on this flight." which we actually, I saw no evidence of that myself. but it was at least something that he could try to get people's attention. But we did eventually descend uneventfully into Karachi, and people in Washington had said before we went back, I didn't have any particular anxiety about the return. Never know what you don't know, but it seemed that President Musharraf was going to be committed to her landing as safely as possible, and that I think the United States had signaled to him that her safety was something, you know, that they would hold him responsible for, and it all went reasonably smoothly in the way things go reasonably smoothly in Pakistan, which is to say, you know, utterly chaotic, but no blood spilled. And she came down the jetway and down the stairs, and we had been allowed off earlier to look up at her, and she reached the last stair. She'd been away from Pakistan for 10 years. Her family is deeply rooted in Pakistan and is, you know, arguably the most important modern political family in Pakistan, and with the Gandhi family, the Nehru Gandhi family in India, the most important in South Asia. So it's not as if this was anything other than an authentic experience for her, and yet standing at the foot of the stairs, watching her reach the last stair, stop, look up, and tear, I thought, you know, I don't know how to judge the line between performance and experience here, but it was a very powerful moment in any event, and down she came. And the Pakistan People's Party, which she leads, is the largest single political party in Pakistan, and its history, which dates about 35 years, is dominated by the party's ability to bring large numbers of people out into the street. It's a political party, and it is in some meaningful way a democratic party, but it is not democratic in the sense that it has internal elections, for instance. It's more of a movement than a party that is constantly changing its own leadership or reevaluating its own membership. it's based in rural southern Pakistan, and quite a lot of the farmers and townsmen and school teachers and others who depend on party patronage for jobs and other opportunity can be summoned out at moments like this, and there they were, hundreds of thousands of them packed in around the Karachi airport. And this was organized as a show of strength by the People's Party. In fact, they'd spent quite a lot of money to publicize her return, and the city of Karachi was festooned with billboards and other. I brought back my wife a little cap that said, a baseball cap that said, "Welcome home, Benazir." Dr. Beg, Karachi Assembly 250. It was that sort of a kind of political festival. And this crowd of hundreds of thousands prevented her from moving out very quickly. I think that was by design. She intended to get off the plane and ride in a procession to the mausoleum of Pakistan's founder, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, where she was going to deliver a speech. And so we all found our way into the crowd and started floating through this sea of people. And the party had arranged a series of flatbed trucks for people like myself, journalists, to sit on, and so we could watch her in her sort of three-story truck, which had a kind of VIP compartment in the front. And so we did, for hour after hour after hour in the hot sun, sort of float through this crowd and listen to the singing and the chanting. And after about 8 hours or so, as a magazine writer, I figured I'd kind of had enough of this. It was starting to get a little repetitious, and there'd been no food, and we'd been up for a couple of nights. And so I decided to walk out of the procession, and I'd had a car come out to the edge of the mob, and took me a couple kilometers to get out there and go back and find some dinner. And a bunch of colleagues said, "Oh, well, we're coming with you. We don't want to sit around here until 5 in the morning." So we all walked out, and about 2 hours later, the two suicide bombers attacked her her vehicle and killed about 140 people. I interpreted the life lesson as always follow your stomach wherever it leads you. If you're hungry, go eat. But we did come back to the scene, and it was terribly gruesome. One of the glories of working as a journalist in South Asia, however, is that you can walk into a scene like that, essentially a crime scene of a major national assassination attempt, and 2 hours afterwards, the place is not, there's no yellow tape, there's no police haven't arrived yet, and so you can just climb up into her bus and look at the bullet holes yourself and pick up things and walk around it. So it made for an interesting inquiry, and one of the suggestions, though the evidence is far from complete, is that in addition to the two dismounted suicide bombers, who I'm afraid are part of a too familiar pattern of attack in Pakistan these days, there may have also been some gunfire, which led her to believe that this attack on her had not been organized just by radical Islamists, but perhaps by elements of the Pakistani state, the intelligence services, or the police. In fact, she said the next day that before she'd gotten on that flight, she had written a letter to President Musharraf in which she had named three individuals in his government who she believed, on the basis of information that had been provided to her, were conspiring to kill her upon her return. And then she declined to name those individuals. She said she wouldn't name them for as long as she was alive. So she had written this letter as a kind of last will and testament upon her return. And it's still, now the names have kind of leached out. But that's the kind of operatic drama that accompanies violence and politics in Pakistan these days, I'm afraid. So if that's our prelude, what is this narrative really all about? What is going on here with her return? So first I'd like to suggest that what's at work in Pakistan in 2008, assuming this transition rolls into next year, is a partially democratic transition. It is not a transformation of Pakistani politics. This is a bargain that has been put together between two individuals, President Musharraf and Benazir Bhutto, who are very significant political figures in Pakistan and who do lead significant institutions, the army on the one hand and the Pakistan People's Party on the other. But their backroom deal, in effect, while partially Democratic in character and implication, should not be confused for democracy in some constitutional or sustainable sense. It's the beginning of a transition that might or might not eventually lead to a greater democratic opening in Pakistan, but it is not that destination. It is an arranged marriage between two skeptical partners, Benazir Bhutto and Pervez Musharraf. And Benazir Bhutto in particular has a record of arranged marriage in her life that wouldn't make you very optimistic about her undertaking a second one, which I'll get to in a moment. The rationale for this deal is essentially to right a sort of gap in Pakistani politics in which Islamists have grown up since September 11th. General Musharraf and the institution he leads, while complicated and not entirely liberal, both the individual and the institution, nonetheless is committed to this alliance with the United States because of the benefits that he hopes to extract from it and because of his convictions about how to pursue a stable, modernizing, prosperous Pakistan. The People's Party that Benazir Bhutto leads is among the more secular political formations in Pakistan. So in an ideological sense, Benazir Bhutto and Musharraf are natural allies, but they have been estranged by the narrative of Pakistani politics. So the deal isn't that hard to understand. It's essentially taking two secular forces or secular-leaning forces in Pakistani politics and trying to put them together so as to develop a counterterrorism or a counterinsurgency strategy that has a more convincing political component than the current strategy does. One of the lessons in Pakistan over the last 6 or 7 years, which is sadly a lesson that the United States is now learning, has already learned in Iraq, is that these kinds of insurgencies generally do not have purely military solutions available. And in Pakistan, the absence of a convincing political track, as well as a weak military track, has led to a worsening Islamist problem. And so the rationale for the transition is to try to begin a political strategy by unifying two secular political groups. Well, who are the one of the problems with this deal is that it relies very powerfully upon the qualities of these two individuals and their ability to carry their institutions with them. Particularly, that is so with Benazir, who is the unquestioned leader of the Pakistan People's Party. It is equally true of General Musharraf, who has promised to shed his army uniform and become a civilian president, but who's still the most significant army leader and will be at least for a period of months and perhaps longer than that. So who are these people, Benazir and General Musharraf? Let's start with Benazir. I would imagine, other than those of you who are students of Pakistan, that your impressions of her are shaped in part by her experience in the West. She attended Harvard and Oxford. She was president of the Oxford Union as a student there. Her English is flawless. She's articulate. She's sharp. She's self-possessed. She is comfortable in Western idioms, in Western vernaculars. But she really is a daughter of Pakistan, as I think she would even describe herself. And there is a way in which her Western interlocutors have long struggled to understand the sources of her Pakistani identity. To encounter those, you would have to travel first to her hometown, which is in a rural district of Sindh province north of Karachi, a town called Larkana, which is irrigated by the Indus River. And it is essentially a feudal setting, as Pakistanis themselves would put it, in the sense that there are very large landholders and quite a lot of sharecropping farmers who have been bound together in social, economic, and more recently political arrangements with only gradual changes in their relations with one another over a long period of time. And the Bhuttos, who probably came to this part of Pakistan 500, 600 years ago, were, when Benazir grew up as a child, among the largest landholders in this particularly sort of landlord-centric region. So that she came up in a life of rural aristocratic privilege and splendor and a sense of entitlement and a sense of place. But her father, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, was a populist firebrand, became a populist firebrand, left-leaning politician in the 1970s, and with colleagues in this area, created the Pakistan People's Party as a sort of a Pakistani answer to leftist popular movements sprouting around the developing world. When he was overthrown and hung by a Pakistani general, Benazir was barely, I think, 21, and her brothers had been forced into exile, and she was with her father as he went to the gallows. So her experience of politics, even before she reached Harvard and Oxford, was informed by a sense of high stakes and violence and complicated rural settings that her American accent and her fluency in American political vernacular masks. And I think that's not a criticism of her, it's just an observation about who she is. And everyone around her comes from these spaces, these cultural and political spaces, and they encourage this sense of her regalness, which was very much on display upon her return. So there's this ambiguity in the People's Party. People's Party in what sense? Is it really a democratic, popular movement, or is it a modernized expression of these sort of feudal arrangements? And the answer is it's both. It remains both. I will shortcut the operatic Bhutto family history and fast forward to the moment of her marriage to Asif Zardari in 1987. At that time, she had returned from exile. Her father was in the grave. The Pakistan army was under pressure to undergo a transition very similar to the one that we're watching now by permitting her to return from exile. She returned, and in order to secure a political family that she could operate from, she needed to marry. And so her family arranged her marriage to Asif Zardari, who was a, like her, from rural Sindh, though not from such a grand family. And he is the man who's become known to those who watch Pakistan as Mr. 10%, because he was regarded as a self-interested businessman who exploited her time as Prime Minister of Pakistan to enrich himself and her as well. And so he remains a very complicated factor in her return, because he is, by all accounts, quite an unpopular figure in Pakistan because of these corruption charges. She served two tours as prime minister, both ended prematurely when essentially the army threw her out. The first time they charged her with corruption, but there really isn't much evidence that she had gotten very deeply involved in anything of scale. She seems more likely to have been thrown out the first time because she was challenging some of the army's nuclear weapons activities at a time where she sort of overstepped her station in the army's view. The second time she was thrown out, there was a very broad, in 1996, there was a very broad perception that she and her husband were exploiting political office for personal gain. And investigations in the subsequent 10 years have suggested that indeed quite a lot of money ended up offshore in Switzerland and elsewhere. She has left the country voluntarily because of the possibility that if she stayed, she'd go to jail on these corruption charges. And so her return required the negotiation of an immunity deal for herself and all of the members of her party, so that all of the financial corruption and political corruption charges that were pending in Pakistani courts have now essentially been tentatively dismissed. And that has made this deal between herself and General Musharraf really quite unpopular with many Pakistanis, because it emphasizes the backroom and sort of, in certain perceptions, cynical nature of this arrangement. So who's her partner? Who is General Musharraf? He, I think, first thing to understand about him, as with anyone who's had a long career in the military, is what was the nature of his military career? Well, he's a commando. He's a special forces risk taker, a man who sees himself as a bold, transforming man of action. And he has, if you read his memoir, he has a high degree of self-confidence, you would say, if you were being generous. He lists in the book every merit, certificate of merit and award that he has ever won in his life, and he even lists the fact that when he was 17 and in boarding school, I think in Lahore, that he placed second in the Mr. Universe bodybuilding contest at his school. So he's a bright guy, but he doesn't take a lot of counsel, according to the people who have worked with him. And he, as I say, where he has suffered in his time in office since he took power in what, in fairness, was an involuntary coup. It was not a coup that he initiated. It was a coup that was sort of brought upon him by Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. But he's seized the day and enjoyed his run as the unquestioned and unrivaled leader of Pakistan. But where he has suffered, it's been usually from his inability to act in coalition and to act subtly and to take counsel and to build a sustainable political groupings that would protect his interests and protect the army's interests. And that's another reason why I think there's some reason to be skeptical about this partnership, is that neither of these people are natural coalition builders. They both are very strong and self-regarding leaders who don't have a long record of successful partnerships of this kind. What are the structural obstacles that Pakistan faces as it attempts to make this transition and attempts to essentially deprive the Islamists in Pakistan of political oxygen? That's what this project is all about. You have two very large, broadly rooted organizations. The army, which is a middle class organization and a very broadly based organization in Pakistan, and the People's Party, which is a complementary, large, broadly based organization. If these two groupings can collaborate together politically over a period of 3 to 5 years at all successfully, they can start to pull some of the oxygen away from the Islamist political parties and groupings that have sheltered and supported so many of the violent actors, such as those that turned up in Karachi a couple of weeks ago. That's the theory of the case. But the obstacles to that project are formidable. And probably the most important of them is what Benazir herself was describing in the letter that she wrote to Musharraf, which is what some people call the deep state in Pakistan. That is to say, the layers of intelligence and political operatives who have been radicalized by 20 years of warfare on the Afghan border and on the Kashmir border, and who, while they wear uniforms in some cases and they belong to formal military and intelligence and police services in some cases, they are not entirely loyal to the state, and they are certainly not loyal to the agenda of President Musharraf and his American and NATO allies, who are, you know, these days fighting what is really quite an unpopular war on the Western frontier. So there are layers within layers in the Pakistani state, and many of the intelligence officers and police officers who have been involved in promoting Islamist groups in order to fight wars against India or to fight wars against Soviet-occupied and later Afghan communist run Afghanistan, those officers have taken up the cause of their clients. They may have started out as professionals engaged in covert action, but many of them have themselves been radicalized by events in Pakistan and by the ideology that they were promoting. Some of them have retired, some of them are working in place. Very few of them see Benazir Bhutto as the solution to Pakistan's ills. And the complexity. This is sort of, if you ever watch movies and you know the director Oliver Stone, who's sort of notorious for his love of conspiracy theories. I mean, this he should be making movies in Pakistan, because here it's actually true that the intelligence services are collaborating to kill presidents and prime ministers, rather than in the United States, where he, I think, just sort of fantasizes about it. And this history is now, you know, very much present in the surge of violence and radicalization that we see, particularly along the Western frontier, as I say, but also in the heartland in places like Punjab. These Muslim Brotherhood influence networks, while they have not taken over mainstream society and politics in Pakistan, they are encroaching upon it in ways that simply wasn't true 10 or 20 years ago. What can we expect? What do we want from the point of view of the United States? And I'll try to finish this in just a minute or two. The goal is easy to describe. I think it's a goal that many Pakistanis would embrace. It's a goal that the government of India would embrace. It's certainly a goal that the United States, United Kingdom, and NATO allies and the European Union would endorse, which is the pursuit, however difficult, of a stable, modernizing, prosperous Pakistan that is at peace with its neighbors and at peace with itself to the greatest extent possible. Now, that is a daunting project. It is a 10 or 20 year project, but it cannot be achieved without pluralism and democracy and as one element of the bargain. And so this transition in that sense is meant to be a down payment on the renewal of that project. But is the United States government in its current foreign policy actually aiding that project? Is it supporting it? The Center for Strategic and International Studies published a report just a week ago that described U.S. aid to Pakistan since September 11th. If you count an estimate of covert aid as well as overt aid, the total figure is probably about 15 billion with a B. Most of that money, the great majority of it, has been direct cash transfers to the Pakistan Army or direct cash transfers to the federal budget that's controlled by the Pakistan Army. $15 billion. The total amount spent on Pakistani schools, about $60 million. We have militarized our foreign policy, not just in Iraq, but in places where we're not even paying attention. And I feel some confidence in saying that this disproportionate package is not the product of a deliberate decision in the United States government. It's just what happens when we put our machinery on automatic pilot, and where we don't have a national strategy or a discourse about a strategy that undertakes something other than military solutions to these complex problems. So I'll just finish by saying that for many people who watch Pakistan, many of us who were on that trip as Benazir went back, the question is always, can Benazir survive? Can Musharraf and Benazir form a partnership? But I think a question that we should be asking here in this room and in the presidential campaign ahead is, can we be a better ally? Thank you for your time and attention.
I'd like to start by asking sort of a follow-up to your opening comments. As a reporter, you have been scrupulous in maintaining a sense of neutrality, but in some of your pieces for The New Yorker, you have permitted yourself to express opinions, and I wonder if you would be a little bit prescriptive about what you think America's foreign policy ought to be towards Pakistan. What are the things that we ought to be doing? What are the things that those who aspire to lead the country from both parties ought to be advocating?
Well, I would, if anyone's interested in a deep take on that question, I would recommend the CSIS report that Fred Barton and some others have put together. It's really an excellent document, unusual as these things go in its detail and its attention. And I think the answer begins with the observation that I ended on, which is, first of all, we have to demilitarize the nature of our alliance. That's in our interest. It's in the interest of the campaign that we are waging jointly in partnership with the Pakistan Army, and it's in the interest of the goal that I articulated before, which is what it's all about, the attempt to achieve a stable, modernizing, prosperous, democratic Pakistan. And that, however, is a very tricky project because the United States, Great Britain, and the people of Afghanistan face a security emergency that the Pakistan Army is attempting to address. And that security emergency is the loss of control over not just the federally administered tribal areas, the Waziristans that we have all come to know about, where al-Qaeda has reconstituted itself, but also the neighboring provinces of Northwest Frontier and parts of Balochistan are falling outside of Pakistani state control. There's a very nasty situation in a place called Swat at the moment, where a kind of a young generation of Taliban have taken over a town in Pakistan and have been holding public executions. And these sorts of things just didn't happen down in nasty areas of the frontier 10 years ago. So there has to be a balance in recalibrating American approaches to Pakistan that, on the one hand, broaden our engagement, use our resources and our influence to the extent that we can, our trade regime, our direct aid, our partnership with the World Bank and the IMF, our partnership with our allies to broaden engagements, to promote the civil society and education reform and market economy and human rights groups and other symptoms of a healthy democratic society, which, by the way, are visible right across the border in India. One of the most powerful motivations in Pakistan for all things is rivalry with India. And the only reason that I retain hope that this project in 20 or 30 years, if we come back together and talk about it, might look a little bit more like Southeast Asia and a little bit less like a disaster, is because I think India is going to succeed spectacularly during the next 20 or 30 years. And that is going to, in a lot of complicated ways, force Pakistan into alignment, or it may. It's going to create opportunities for Pakistan, and one of them is an opportunity of democracy. So it's a long answer, and I could go on for a long while, but I would just say that there is a vector in which the United States has to manage its real and short-term security needs by waging this campaign against militants in Western Pakistan, and at the same time begin to build for the medium and long term much more effectively than we have done. We have dug a hole in the last 5 or 6 years by pouring all of this money down one side of the pipe, and we've now got to readjust that engagement while not letting go of the security emergency in the short run.
thank you, Steve. In our Constitution, the president is the commander-in-chief, in charge of the entire army. And in Pakistan, they clearly have a problem with the army taking over with coups. And so it's understandable where Musharraf would be very reluctant to give up his general status, because the question is, how does the Pakistani constitution govern this transition and keep the military? Who's that responsible to?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I, again, you could talk for a while about it, but one of the sort of more hopeful signs of political change in Pakistan this year has been the emergence of this lawyers movement and really the rebirth of what many Pakistanis would recognize as familiar, ordinary strands of politics in Pakistan. And the lawyers have been campaigning to defend the Constitution, and their idealism and their willingness to go out into the streets and take risks and their willingness to assert the ideal of an independent judiciary and their willingness to chant slogans that make reference to the Constitution is all very inspiring. But there really isn't a Constitution in Pakistan. There isn't a meaningful one. I mean, what there is there's a kind of a national collective wish that there be a stable Constitution, but there isn't a stable Constitution. There's a Constitution that is written down and then is abrogated and changed and run over by tank treads or by political schemers. And so there's both a search for a stable constitutional order and a very fluid set of inheritances. And the short version of the engineering question you've asked is that there have been periods of time in recent Pakistani constitutional history where Pakistan has been governed, in effect, by a troika, if that's the way you pronounce it, the chief of the army staff with an informal but very powerful role, the president, who has powers analogous to the French president and then the Prime Minister, who leads the National Assembly. And the President is elected by a franchise of assemblies rather than directly elected. That's a difference with France. But it's essentially an attempt to have a balance of power. And they keep, this setup has failed every time it's been attempted. And they keep rewriting it to try to get it correct. Benazir has a whole series of demands now about what she wants to see done. And one of her principal demands is that she wants to deprive the president, who will be Musharraf, is Musharraf, of the right to dismiss her if she became prime minister. That there have been times where that has been the law of the land, but it is not currently the law of the land. She would like to make it the law of the land again. And, you know, it goes on and on. Even people who are deeply interested, as I am, in these questions, I think find themselves confused and a little bit demoralized by the diversity of possible constitutional arrangements that have been practiced and may yet again be practiced.
Yes, hi. I would like to ask you a question in regards to Afghanistan.
Sure.
With the Iraq war sort of at the front of our minds and Afghanistan, you know, literally slipping into or in the back of our minds, what is going to happen if we get Afghanistan wrong this time? And the second part of the question would be, do we understand this, both at the administration level and at the public level?
We don't understand it. That part is easy to answer. I think there's one of the many aspects of the tragedy of the invasion of Iraq and the failed attempt to occupy and stabilize Iraq is seen today in Afghanistan, where the diversion of national resources, attention, and potential that has been so overwhelming in Iraq has created gaps and spaces and failed potential in Afghanistan, which is today producing a worsening, steadily worsening security situation. You ask, what are the implications of the trend line? Afghanistan, of course, is not made up of a uniform population. About roughly half of the country are identified commonly as Pashtuns, and they predominate primarily in the south and east. And the rest of the population is a mix of ethnic and linguistic groups that have shared political space and sometimes successfully political partnership with Pashtuns in Afghanistan, but are congregated primarily in the north and to some extent in the west. And the Taliban are a product, it's important to understand, of Pashtun grievances and Pashtun aspirations and Pashtun cultural traditions to a very large extent. They are not, you can't say that they're exclusively a Pashtun movement, but they're almost, the great majority of their appeal is in Pashtun territory. Now, Pashtuns are like the Kurds. They spill across colonial era borders, and so there are actually more Pashtuns living in Pakistan than there are in Afghanistan, and that explains the tumult in the federally administered tribal areas and the adjoining provinces of NWFP and to some extent Balochistan. So if you extrapolate what's happening now in the federally administered tribal areas and NWFP with the worsening security situation in southern and eastern provinces in Afghanistan, you can imagine a future in which the government of Afghanistan and the government of Pakistan lose control of their sections of this population to a great degree, and that the security environment makes it very difficult to engage in development work, and political campaigning is quelched by violence, as now occurs in the federally administered tribal areas. The Islamists on the Pakistan side of the border have essentially assassinated so many of their secular and nationalist political rivals that it's very difficult to engage in politics in that territory if you're not the Taliban. And the danger in southern and eastern Afghanistan is that will become the mirror image in southern and eastern Afghanistan. It's difficult for me to imagine that as long as NATO and the United States are engaged that Kabul will ever be lost, but Kabul could become a nasty place. And in any event, nobody wants to get that far. It is important that the United States and Europe turn their attention to this deterioration as quickly as possible. And the difficulty is that the pace of our disengagement from Iraq is a factor in our national capacity to make this turn. And I fear we've got still several years to run there.
In your book, Ghost Wars, which I strongly recommend, you talk about how the United States really didn't have a long-term coherent foreign policy strategy in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I was wondering if you still think today that the U.S. really has attention deficit disorder in this region, and why is that, and will this continue?
Well, you know, it's a complicated question because American policy is now informed by the lesson that we abandoned Afghanistan. So there is a consensus that you can see actually in both political parties that we're not going to turn and repeat the errors of the early 90s when we essentially abandoned engagement with Afghanistan. So there is at least an understanding that a stable, unified Afghanistan at peace with its neighbors and a stable, modernizing Pakistan at peace with its neighbors are both 20-year projects. I mean, politicians don't like to say that out loud, but I mean, they are. They're 20, they're 30-year projects, probably. And so in that sense, the lesson, you know, the context is a little bit different now. But the part that hasn't been adjusted is the mechanisms by which the United States uses its national potential and power and influence to try to shape events in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. And there, I fear, we are very much repeating the patterns and errors of the 1980s alliance with the Pakistan Army, where we have, as I said before, militarized our aid. We have failed to broaden the base of our engagement. We have failed to convince our partners that we're in it for reasons other than narrow self-interest. And in Afghanistan, we have failed to develop a program of stabilization and national recovery that lives up to our potential. The United States is not, is not a natural nation builder, and it is, it has struggled in many environments where it has attempted to use concrete and roads and school buildings as a substitute for sustainable political strategy and national development. But we are not without partial successes, working with allies, working with the United Nations, working with NATO, and admittedly in more familiar and more comfortable European contexts like the Balkans, there are models that, if applied to Afghanistan with the same alliances, with the same international mechanisms, with the same goals, might well by now, absent the Iraq War, have produced a more convincing, I'm sure, still complicated and messy, but recovering Afghanistan. And there's one fundamental reason: Afghans have an appetite for national recovery. Afghans want a stable, peaceful country. You are not fighting an internal civil war that is bubbling under your feet. You are swimming with the national tide. And it's just disheartening that with that opportunity, we and our allies have nonetheless struggled so badly.
I was born and raised in Afghanistan, so I have a couple of questions for you here. Given the relationship between the United States and Pakistan has been really confusing to me all the time, why the United States does not adopt a foreign policy toward controlling the region, which is actually in flames right now, including SWAT? And also, the United States has been very reluctant in helping Afghan army stand up on its feet. Afghan army has been done very, very well recently, and that's why basically my question was that how can we fix those problems? Why we have not addressed those issues? Thank you.
Well, the failure to train, equip, and deploy the Afghan army is one of the particulars in the broader observation that the Iraq War and the drain on resources and national attention has had these debilitating consequences for national recovery in Afghanistan. The Afghan army today is a stronger force than it was 3 or 4 years ago, but it's considerably less strong than it might have been if we had had the national sort of space and attention and resources to devote to its speedy reconstruction. And many of you who have been in government or have been around government or have passed through it, I'm sure recognize, but even those of us who are sort of living in Washington and in and around these conversations are occasionally caught up by the descriptions of people on the inside of just how draining Iraq is in day-to-day experience of governance today in the United States. It is all Iraq all the time. It's the sheer scale of the project, the number of vehicles, the number of spare parts, the number of memos, the number of problems, the size of the embassies and the associated government outposts there, just the sheer overwhelming gravity of that war makes it very difficult, even for a large and well-resourced nation like ours, to do Afghanistan at the same time with anything like the attention and resources that it requires. As to U.S. policy in Western Pakistan, there's this sort of discussion, and it surfaced in the earlier Democratic debates, about whether the United States should go directly into Waziristan and try to break up some of these cells of reconstituted al-Qaeda. And of course, there is a sense of urgency about that because some of the violent plots that have come out to Great Britain in particular, you know, have clear the police work and investigations following the subway, or the tube bombings in London, but even more importantly, this near miss that many of you may not even remember, which was the airlines plot of August 2006, where a cell was broken up in Britain just before it attempted to, this is the cell that deprived you of your toothpaste, the ones that were going to bring the flammable liquids aboard. But the reason that the reason you can't have toothpaste and shampoo anymore is because this was actually quite a serious conspiracy that was very ambitious. And it's not one of these sort of fake terror stories. It was a real conspiracy that might well, if but for the accident of discovery by British investigative personnel, have produced 900 dead or 1,000 dead over the Atlantic. And you can imagine, and then the forensic trail from that investigation would have led into Western Pakistan. And you can imagine, and I've been at conferences with folks in and out, and recently in and out of government, ones who are still in, the political imperative to go in with American and NATO forces into Waziristan and into Western Pakistan would be very powerful at that time. And I don't think there are very many people who are convinced that the United States would be successful with that operation for anything other than, you know, maybe 6 weeks, and that the only way, unfortunately, to regain control of this territory is by subtler means. And the Pakistan Army, which is unfortunately not a very effective or motivated counterinsurgency force, is still the worst of all the bad options. I mean, still the best of all the bad options, so far as I can tell. I just don't see another way at the moment. There has got to be a medium and long-term political strategy that is successful. But in the meantime, that's the only way in.
This is sort of a follow-up to the end of the last question. In terms of, since 9/11, we've talked about the willingness of the Pakistani army to go into Waziristan and other provinces on the border of Afghanistan, and its reluctance to do so in part due to its long-term alliance with Islamic parties. But it seems now that we're talking about its ability to be effective even after we've dumped billions of dollars of aid into its program. So I was wondering if you could speak to that. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's a valid observation. And you know, one reason why the Pakistan army has trouble operating in Western Pakistan and in the tribal areas is because of demography. If you go back to our sort of quick map of Pakistan, Afghanistan, and you really drill down into sort of authentic detail, you'd see that in these tribal areas there are groupings of Pashtuns and related tribal networks whose membership crosses over into the Pakistan security services locally. The paramilitary frontier corps is almost all raised from local populations, then equipped, given guns, and told to stand on the corner and shoot at their cousins. Well, people just don't do that. And when you see these groups, like the news reports that come out of the Fatah, you know, 75 frontier corpsmen were kidnapped yesterday. Well, I usually, you know, I mean, I'm sure some of these situations may be quite serious, but I kind of chuckle because I can imagine, you know, a kind of big clan picnic gathering in which one side of the clan turns the other side of the clan, says, oh, by the way, you're not going home, but, you know, there's some excellent mutton over here and you're officially kidnapped. Because there's so much blending between the frontier corps and the local tribal sort of leadership structures and networks that it's very difficult to expect the frontier corps in particular to do much heavy lifting. They can stand on roadsides and make radio reports, but even that isn't going to be very reliable. Now, the army, when it comes up there, is made up of Punjabis from the sweltering plains who are regarded by the locals as, you know, foreigners bent on occupation, pillage, and plunder. And they're regarded as alien a force as the Americans. It's just that they may not be so conspicuous in an army uniform, but that doesn't mean that they can drive down the streets of Miram Shah with any more impunity than the Americans can. And in fact, the Americans, when the Americans go up there and try to operate under the radar, they do it in the company of the army. But it's just, it's even these Pakistani army units in their jeeps can't drive 3 or 4 miles without getting whacked by an IED or snipered, because everybody knows who's local and who's not, and the army is not.
My question is about the Pakistani intelligence organization. Is it primarily a local group with its own agenda, or could it become part of a broader Islamist movement like Al-Qaeda or the Taliban? Or could it possibly be recruited by a Musharraf-Bhutto combination to participate in the democratization of Pakistan?
It's all those things already, essentially. And it is all those things. I mean, the principal intelligence, military intelligence service in Pakistan is called the Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate, ISI, as it's normally shorthanded. And it's best understood as a division of the army. It is it's led usually by a two-star. Its main bureaus are led by brigadiers. And it's sort of paper, its mission on paper is a sort of standard foreign intelligence collection, primarily about India and covert action, which has been a disproportionate extent of its life because of the wars on two borders. But it has also been involved in internal security, coup prevention, election manipulation, you know, political formations, formation and funding and nurturing of political parties. I mean, it does everything. And one reason why these sort of pockets of radicalization have sprung up and persisted in its ranks is that to carry out the covert war against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan during the 1980s, and then later to prosecute a similar campaign against Indian forces in Kashmir, ISI was organized into, among other things, covert bureaus that supported Islamist militias fighting in both campaigns. So there was an Afghan bureau, I presume there still is an Afghan bureau, of ISI that was responsible for funding, arming, nurturing, providing banking and other services to Islamist militia leaders during the during the anti-Soviet war, and then again nurtured and attempted to manage the Taliban as they were born in the late 1990s. And similarly, in Kashmir, there was a Kashmir bureau that was staffed by brigadiers, colonels, majors, captains. And what happened in a lot of these cases is that people who were assigned to these jobs stayed for a long while. And particularly in Western Afghanistan, Pashtun officers, who make up about 15-20% of the officer corps of the Pakistan Army, because they could blend, because they spoke Pashto, they were assigned to these bureaus, given the kind of client relationships, and they stayed out there for a long while. Well, there was lots of things going on in those assignments. There was a lot of money floating through. There were a lot of rackets. There was a lot of heroin smuggling. There was a lot of television smuggling. And there was a war to fight. And some people stayed for a long time, and essentially it became difficult to tell who was the client and who was the controlling officer. And I think similar things have happened in Kashmir. Now, you add to that the general context of radicalization, anti-American feeling, and nationalism that has arisen in Pakistan and much of the Islamic world since 9/11, and you can easily see segments of these services that would be inclined to either be passive or to actively collaborate with groups that they thought could dismantle or disrupt the what is regarded as the American project in Pakistan.
I have a question that will allow you to fulfill your publicized title of your remarks. Saudi Arabia. Could you share with us some thoughts about how that country, that ally, that largely undemocratic ally of ours, absent oil, fits into this whole equation of Islamic terrorism and the whole geopolitical situation in that part of the world?
Sure. So the short version. As Pakistan has become more unstable in some ways during the last 3 or 4 years, Saudi Arabia has become more stable. The uprising, premature, violent, shocking, but ultimately insignificant of al-Qaeda cells in the kingdom beginning in the spring of 2003 has essentially been quashed. $80 or $90 a barrel oil has had a salutary effect on many aspects of internal Saudi politics, if you want to call it politics, since there's basically no oxygen in the entire kingdom, but there's quite a lot of money flowing through it. And the money appeases many groups, including all kinds of dissident formations or potential dissident formations. It also buys probably the most expensive per capita informer network in the entire world. I mean, you feel like you can't walk around the corner without somebody picking up their phone and talking about it. So the security regime there, which looked a little shaky and had people both in the kingdom and outside nervous, seems to have tightened up considerably and now looks very well funded. Saudi Arabia's perceptions then have shifted from their concerns about al-Qaeda, which they had earlier downplayed in the aftermath of 9/11, but then addressed in the aftermath of these May 2003 and subsequent attacks. Saudi perceptions and concerns have now shifted to the regional equation, and particularly to the sectarian conflict in Iraq and spilling over Iraq's borders between Sunni and Shia. And Saudi Arabia is an ardently Sunni political and military culture with tribal and religious and other ideological ties to Sunni groupings in Anbar and elsewhere in Iraq. More broadly, it lives in a state of perpetual concern about Shia-led Iran and its appetite for Saudi oil resources in the eastern provinces where the local populations are Shia, where there's been restiveness in the past. And so you can pull that lens, keep pulling it back all the way to Lebanon, keep pulling it back to the broader picture in the Middle East, and what Saudi Arabia, I think, is most concerned about these days is the unintended sectarian conflict that the American invasion of Iraq has unleashed and its implications for Saudi security and prosperity over the next 10 or 20 years. So if there is an outright civil war in Iraq, the Saudis have more or less already announced that they're coming in on what is in effect al-Qaeda's side, which is a little bit harsh, but nonetheless, I think, fair to observe, because they regard the disenfranchised Sunnis in Iraq as a besieged minority who require their support, both in Saudi self-interest, but also in this kind of broader context of sectarian competition.
I'll take you back to Pakistan. If Pakistan and India were able to solve the Kashmir problem, how much influence would that have on the resolution of some of the political problems in Pakistan?
That's a great question. And if you gave me a genie in a bottle, and he came out and he said, you can have one wish in Pakistan or in and around Pakistan granted, not transferable to other regions of the world, I would wish for a convincing, comprehensive settlement between India and Pakistan. And if I could finish my sentence before the genie cut me off, I would say, including Kashmir, but also all other border and economic and trade issues. Because the possibility of a sustainable confederation between India and Pakistan over the next 20 or 30 years is the ticket out of this mess. It is absolutely the ticket out. And Pakistan right now is growing at 6 or 7% a year. It's just that the political economy is so broken that many Pakistanis don't have any notion that the economy is growing at 6 or 7% a year. You know, the economy in India is growing at 7, 8, 9, 10% a year, and the sense of possibility and the sense of prosperity, while not universally shared, while giving rise to a whole new set of problems of income equality and social equality and all kinds of other stresses, nonetheless, there is, I think, a broad sense of confidence in India that is going to reinforce its democratic constitution because of this pathway to prosperity. And it's not going to exacerbate the tensions in India's constitutional arrangements. I think it's going to reinforce the strength of India's democratic constitution. Something similar could happen in Pakistan. And all of these narrow problems of whether Benazir and Pervez Musharraf can work it out and whether the political parties in the Punjab are too infected by the Muslim Brotherhood, all of that would just start to dissolve. You know, sand would kind of wash out of the picture gradually. And you've seen this in so many other troubled political economies in Southeast Asia. We don't have to invent this narrative. If you go back to what Korea looked like in the late 1950s, or you go back to post-colonial Malaysia, and you visit those countries today, it's remarkable what the quintupling of national GDP will do for local politics.
Steve Call's next book, which will focus on the history and influence of the bin Laden family, is scheduled to be published in April. And I think, Steve, I speak for everyone here, and I say I hope we can get you back to talk about that.
My pleasure, George.
Thank you.